This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Hot and Badgered by Shelley Laurenston, narrated by Tracy Odom. Prologue. Charles Taylor didn't realize until that moment how fast life could flip on a man. One second he'd been listening to two crazy women he'd known for years try to talk him into taking over the pack from the young, arrogant wolf they all hated. The next second the doorbell rang, and everything changed. Forever. He'd opened the front door to the main pack house and found his 12-year-old granddaughter standing there with her two half-sisters. The other two weren't his granddaughters. His daughter had taken in the offspring of her worthless ex-boyfriend, because that's what she was like, his Carly. She'd taken those girls in and raised them like her own. Without question. Without resentment. And because it was the right thing to do, as far as Carly was concerned. So when Charles opened the front door and saw those three girls standing there, dirty, bruised, with that wounded look in their eyes, he knew. He knew his baby girl was gone. He knew it and was devastated by it. But what could he do? Do what his daughter would want. Take the three girls in. Raise them. Even the two who weren't only not his blood, but weren't even a tiny bit wolf. The middle one was full honey badger, like her idiot father and her criminal mother, who was doing hard time in a Bulgarian prison after a jewelry heist went bad. The second one was half honey badger and half tiger, and his packmates were not fans of cats. Not even a little. They didn't tolerate the house cats that roamed around their Wisconsin neighborhood. So what would they do to this little one with the big eyes and the stink of cat coming off her? The girls did have one thing in their favor, though. They were young. The oldest 12, the middle 11, and the baby not even 8 yet. When the two she-wolves saw the girls, they gasped and immediately ushered the children in, leading them to the living room he'd just escaped from.
"What happened?" Lottie asked his granddaughter. "Where's your mama?"
His granddaughter looked up at him, and again he saw the answer in her eyes. Just as he'd seen the answer when he'd opened the front door. "My daughter's dead," he said flatly, still trying to process exactly what that meant. Lottie and Jane went silent, hands stopping on the light coats the girls had worn to trek from Connecticut to Wisconsin to get to their mother's pack. In the middle of winter. Aghast, the two she-wolves looked up at him, then at each other.
Let's get you girls something to eat," Jane stuttered. "You must be starving."
Lottie stood and softly said to Charles,
"We may have a problem with two of them."
"If I have to leave, I will."
He thought of his daughter, of how she would have handled something like this.
"I won't separate them."
Lottie pressed her hand against Charles's chest.
"I'll go talk to him."
He nodded and crouched down in front of his granddaughter to help take off her coat. But before he had a chance, Lottie quickly returned.
"He wants to talk to them, alone."
Frowning, Charles looked at his old friend over his shoulder.
"What?"
She shrugged.
"Forget it," he said.
He wasn't putting his traumatized granddaughter and her sisters through that idiot's bullshit.
"We'll talk to him,"
his granddaughter suddenly announced, sounding adult. She might look like a little girl, but she'd never actually been one. Carly used to say, "My girl was born 40." And seeing the determined look on the child's sweet face, Charles believed it. She stood and motioned to her sisters.
"Where is he?"
she asked a stunned Lottie.
"In the back, the yard. We'll find him."
While the middle girl held the youngest's hand, his granddaughter gently pushed the pair forward, and the three of them walked through the house alone. That's when Jane growled,
"I don't like this."
Neither did Charles. He didn't like it at all. Betsy sprawled on the high branches of the big tree in the pack's backyard and did her best to stay quiet. She came out here to be left alone. She was too old to hang around the other pups and too young to hang around the adults. And at 16, she was counting down the days until she would go off to college and get the fuck out of here. She loved her mom. She'd done the best she could for her only child. But Betsy had never fit in with the pack because she wasn't full wolf. She was half wolf, half black bear. Her father had been a one-night stand her mother had still not gotten over. But being a bear among wolves was challenging. While Betsy was growing up, things had at least been tolerable, until Billy Lewis had taken over as pack leader. Now Betsy was praying nothing came between her and the scholarships that would allow her to go to an out-of-state college and get into a new life. Until then, she'd sit in trees when she wasn't in school and hope that no one noticed her. Like Billy Lewis, sitting on one of the benches in the pack's backyard, looking over his domain like Richard III. But such a weak wolf wouldn't notice that Betsy was sitting in a tree watching him unless the wind suddenly changed and he scented her. She watched as the three little girls came into the backyard. According to what she'd heard when Lottie came to talk to Billy, their mother had been killed, and somehow those little kids had made it halfway across the country to the pack house. Remarkable, really. At that age, Betsy wouldn't have lasted 5 seconds without her mother. But these girls... Billy had insisted on a private chat with the pups, and that did not bode well. Billy didn't like what he called half-breeds, an insulting term from an insulting idiot. Sadly, Betsy had been forced to endure a private chat with Billy herself. It wasn't nearly as creepy as it sounded, but it was definitely cruel. He told her that come her 18th birthday, she was out, no matter what was going on in her life or her mother's. If her mother wasn't happy about it, she could go with her kid, but that would be up to Betsy. A horrifying thought, since Betsy knew how much her mother loved her pack. Leaving it, even for her only daughter, would be too harsh for her. Betsy would never ask that. So, after that private chat, she doubled up on her schoolwork, began taking AP courses, and planned on graduating when she was 17. Thankfully, she was smart enough to make that happen. But she didn't know anything about the little girls walking into the backyard to be left alone with Billy. She just knew her heart broke for them. Because no matter what their circumstances, yes, even the death of their mother, who'd been a former packmate and daughter of the pack's beta, it would mean nothing to Billy Lewis. Besides, this might be the chance he'd been waiting for, to get rid of Charles Taylor, an old school wolf that the adults in the pack desperately wanted as alpha leader, whether Charles would take the job or not. Betsy knew, though, that Charles would never let his granddaughter go into the cruel system of foster homes and state-run lives. That was not the best world for any child, but definitely not for a shifter. And for a hybrid shifter? Nightmares were made of how badly those situations could end. Still, to send the other two girls away simply because they weren't blood-related or wolves, could Billy really be that cruel? Who was she kidding? Of course he could be that cruel. The three girls stood in front of Billy now, and he smugly stared at them, the corners of his mouth slightly turned up, his eyes heartless. If Betsy had thought she could sneak away without being seen, she would. She didn't want to watch this.
I hear you girls have had a bad time of it lately, huh?
The girls stared at him, but said nothing. But the middle one, she suddenly waved at him, as if in greeting. Surprisingly, and just downright annoying, Billy winked back and pointed his finger at the girl, a move he considered sexy. Yuck. He went on,
"Look, I'm sorry to hear about Carly. I always liked her. A weird wolf, but fun, you know?"
Of course they didn't know. They were kids.
Idiot.
Billy leaned forward, resting his elbows on his knees and clasping his hands in front of him. His sincere look.
I know this will be hard for you guys to understand, but you can stay, he told the oldest,
an adorable brown-skinned girl with lots of curly hair and a pretty face.
But you two can't. I know, he continued, I know this is hard to hear, but you might as well learn now how the real world works.
Something told Betsy these girls already knew how the real world worked. While Billy blathered on, the middle girl sat her younger half-sister down on the bench beside Billy and abruptly walked off. She moved over to the bushes and flowers that had been planted around the yard wall, head down, like she was searching for something. And while she looked, Billy talked to Charles's granddaughter. Just like her grandfather, her face revealed nothing. It was blank, impassive. The middle sister, a very tiny Asian girl with black hair that had a white streak through it, picked something up and returned to her sister's side. Together they gazed at Billy until he noticed that the middle girl was holding something in her hand. His smirk turned into a full-blown smile. Betsy had never met someone who enjoyed bringing out the worst in everyone like Billy did. Even desperate children who just lost their mother.
"Is that for me, sweetheart? You going to hit the big bad wolf with that little rock?"
He leaned in and his voice became so hard, harder than Betsy had ever heard it.
"You swing that thing at me, little girl, and you'll be on the first bus to the closest foster agency. Maybe after a few years you'll meet up with your loser mom in prison. You can have a mother-daughter reunion behind bars."
If Billy was hoping to make the little girl cry, he failed. She didn't cry. She just slowly blinked and kept staring at him. Then, without a word between them, the two oldest girls faced each other. Charles's granddaughter nodded once, and the middle girl pulled her arm back, and with some mighty force for a kid, she swung her fist with the rock in it. Knuckles made contact, and Betsy blinked in shock when she heard something break in the oldest girl's face just before she hit the ground. The youngest glanced up at the sound, but her expression was passive as well. Billy, on the other hand, reared back in shock.
"What in holy—"
While he was busy trying to figure out what was going on, the middle girl grabbed his left hand, and now Betsy understood the weirdly timed wave earlier, and placed it on the bench. She raised the rock and brought it down hard onto Billy's knuckles. Billy howled in pain as the middle girl tossed the rock across the yard. Then, as if some silent cue had been given, she and the youngest burst into copious, dramatic tears, the kind of sobbing that would get the attention of any she-wolf in a 20-mile radius. All the adults at home appeared in the backyard. And what did they see? Two little girls sobbing hysterically. Another little girl nursing her bleeding, broken cheek while bravely attempting to hold back tears, and Billy, with busted knuckles. The middle girl's knuckles were also bruised and bloody, but she held her baby sister close and had her hand curled into a fist and pressed against the child's side, ensuring that none of the adults could see it. Charles moved through the adults until he stood front and center. Betsy had never seen the older wolf like that. He'd always been the calm one, the rational one. He was the great peacemaker of the pack, making sure the small group didn't get into any fights they couldn't possibly win against packs bigger and meaner. But now, Charles was beyond angry. His brown eyes narrow, his breathing heavy, his entire body stiff, a slight tremor running through him every few seconds, and all while he gazed down at Billy. Searching the crowd and seeing no friends, Billy shook his head and raised his hands, palms out.
"Wait a second, I didn't... It wasn't me!"
But with his hands raised like that, all anyone could see was the blood dripping between his fingers and slowly pouring down his wrist. Desperate, Billy pointed at the middle girl.
"It was her!"
As one, the adults all looked at the little Asian girl holding onto her baby sister. And, for a split second, Betsy saw the middle girl's face harden in a way that was a little too adult for a kid so young. The adults never saw it, though, because the youngest girl placed her sobbing face right in front of her sister's. Done on purpose? Betsy wouldn't have thought so. She seemed too young. But after everything that had happened...
"It was!" Billy insisted. "It was her! I would never hit a kid! I wouldn't..."
With a nasty snarl from the back of his throat, Charles reached down, grabbed Billy by his leather jacket, and yanked him off the bench. The adults dragged Billy out, leaving the girls alone. The oldest pulled the youngest girl onto her lap, her arms loose around her waist. The middle girl moved closer, finally resting her head against her sister's arm. For a brief moment, the girls looked their age, but they also looked weathered. Life had been hard on them already, and the oldest didn't even look 13 yet. Charles returned to the backyard. He was scowling, and now there was blood on him. He walked up to the girls and glowered down at them, as was his way. Betsy was sure he had no idea how he must look to people who didn't know what was going on in his head. But the three sisters gazed back at him without flinching. Sighing, he started to turn away, and Betsy knew he was trying to figure out what to do next. What to do about the two girls who were not his blood, not related to him in any way except that his daughter had made them her own. But before he could walk away, the youngest girl reached out and gripped his forefinger with her hand, small fingers squeezing tight. And like that, Charles suddenly had three granddaughters instead of one. He reached down and picked up the youngest in his arms.
"Let's get you a room and something to eat," he suggested,
although it sounded like the orders from a drill sergeant. The eldest grabbed her grandfather's forearm, and the middle girl, not as tall as her elder sister yet, grabbed the chain that attached his wallet to his jeans. Together, in silence, they headed back to the house. Betsy waited a few minutes before she crept down the tree trunk and shifted back to human. She put on her clothes and went around the side of the house so she could enter through the front door. As she came around the garage, the middle girl was waiting for her, and Betsy knew she was waiting for her. Betsy froze in mid-step, gazing down at the kid with her mouth slightly open. The kid stared up at her for what felt like forever, and then, with a little smile, she placed her forefinger against her lips and said, "Shh." Without another word, she turned and walked away, and Betsy wondered if it was possible for her to take some more AP classes so she could get into college even earlier than she'd planned, like maybe next week. Chapter 1 16 years later. What had she been thinking, using the Ride of the Valkyries as a ringtone? Because that shit waking a person up at 6 in the morning was just cruel. Really cruel. And, as always, she'd done it to herself. Forgoing her anxiety meds so she could get drunk with a couple of cute Italian guys that she dumped as soon as the first one's head hit the table. Charlie Taylor McKilligan slapped her hand against the bedside table next to the bed, blindly searching for her damn phone. When she touched it, she was relieved. She had no plan to actually get out of bed any time soon. Not as hungover as she currently was. But she really wanted that damn ringtone to stop. Somehow, without even lifting her head from the pillow she had her face buried in, or opening her eyes, Charlie managed to touch the right thing on her phone screen so that she actually answered it.
"What?"
she growled. "Get out," was the reply. "Get out now." Hangover forgotten, Charlie was halfway across the room when they kicked the door open. She turned and ran toward the sliding glass door she'd left open the night before. She just made it to the balcony outside when something hot rammed into her shoulder, tearing past flesh and muscle and burrowing into bone. The power of it sent her flipping head first over the railing.
"What do you think?"
the jackal shifter asked. Sitting in a club chair in his Milan, Italy hotel suite, Berg Dung gazed at the man holding up a black jacket.
"What do I think about what?"
Berg asked.
"The jacket, for my show tonight."
Berg shrugged.
"I don't know."
"You must have an opinion."
"I don't. I happily have no opinion on what a grown man who is not me should wear."
The jackal sighed.
"You're useless." "I have one job, keeping your crazed fans from tracking you down and stripping the flesh from your bones. That's it. That's all I'm supposed to do. I at no time said that I would ever help you with your fashion sense."
Rolling his eyes, the jackal laid the jacket on the bed and then stared at it, like he expected it to tell him something, to actually speak to him. Berg wanted to complain about this ridiculous job, but how could he when it was the best one he'd had in years? Following a very rich, very polite jackal around so that he could play piano for screaming fans in foreign countries was the coolest gig ever. First class everything. Jets, food, women. Not that Berg took advantage of the women thing too often. He knew most were just trying to use him to get to Cooper Jean-Louis Parker. Coop was the one out there every night, banging away at those Steinway pianos, doing things with his fingers that even Berg found fascinating, and wooing all those lovely females with his handsome jackal looks. Berg was just the guy to get through so they could get to the musical genius. And, unlike some of his friends, being used by beautiful women wasn't one of his favorite things. It was a tolerable thing, but not his favorite.
"I can't decide," the jackal finally admitted. "I know how hard it is to pick between one black jacket and another black jacket.
Which will your black turtleneck go with?"
"It's not just another black jacket, peasant. It's the difference between pure black and charcoal black." "We have a train to catch," Berg reminded Coop. "So could you speed this?"
Both shifters jumped, their gazes locked on the balcony outside the room, visible through doors open to let the fresh morning air in. Another crazed female fan trying to make her way into Coop's room? Some of these women, all of them full humans, were willing to try any type of craziness for just a chance at ending up in the maestro's bed. With a sigh, Berg pushed himself out of the chair and headed across the large room toward the sliding glass doors. It looked like he'd have to break another poor woman's heart. But he stopped when he saw her, a brown-skinned woman, completely naked, which, in and of itself, was not unusual. The women who tried to sneak into Coop's room, no matter the country they might be in, were often naked. What stopped Berg in his tracks was that this woman had blood coming from her shoulder. The blood from a gun wound. Berg motioned Coop back.
"Get in the bathroom," he ordered.
"Oh, come on. I want to see what's..." "I don't care what you want. Get in the..."
The men stopped arguing when they saw him. A man in black military tactical gear, armed with a rifle, handgun, and several blades. He zipped down a line and landed on the railing of their balcony. Berg placed his hand on the gun holstered at his side and stepped in front of Coop.
"Get in the bathroom, Coop,"
he ordered, his voice low.
"We have to help her. Do what I tell you and I will."
The man in black dropped onto the balcony and grabbed the unconscious woman by her arm, rolling her limp body over.
"Now, Coop, go."
Berg moved forward with his weapon drawn from its holster. The man pulled his sidearm and pressed the barrel against the woman's head. Berg aimed his .45 and barked,
"Hey!"
The man looked up, bringing his gun with him. Gazes locked, fingers resting on triggers, each man sizing the other up. And that was when the woman moved. Fast. So fast, Berg knew she wasn't completely human, which immediately changed everything. The woman grabbed her attacker's gun hand by the wrist and held it to the side so he couldn't finish the job on her. She used her free hand to pummel the man's face repeatedly. Blood poured down his lips from his shattered nose, his eyes now dazed. Still holding the man's wrist, she got to her feet. She was tall, maybe 5'10 or 5'11, with broad, powerful shoulders and arms and especially legs, like a much too tall gymnast. She gripped her attacker by the throat with one hand and, without much effort, lifted him up and over the balcony railing. She released him then and unleashed the biggest claws Berg had ever seen from her right hand. Turning away from the attacker, she swiped at the zipline that held him aloft, and Berg cringed a little at the man's desperate screams as he fell to the ground below. That's when she saw Berg. Her claws, coming from surprisingly small hands, were still unsheathed. Her gaze narrowed on him, and her shoulders hunched just a bit. She was readying herself for an attack. To kill the man who could out her as a shifter, he guessed, not having had time to process that he was one, too. Plus, he had a gun, which wouldn't help his cause any.
"It's okay," Berg said quickly, reholstering his weapon. "It's okay. I'm not going to hurt you."
"Yeah,"
Coop said from behind him.
"We just want to help."
Berg let out a frustrated breath.
"I thought I told you to get into the bathroom."
"I wanted to see what's going on."
Coop moved to Berg's side.
"We're shifters, too," he said, using that goddamn charming smile, like this was the time for any of that.
But this woman rolled her eyes in silent exasperation and came fully into the room. She walked right by Berg and Coop and to the bedroom door.
"Wait,"
Berg called out. When she turned to face him, one brow raised in question, he reminded her,
"You're naked."
He went to his already packed travel bag and pulled out a black T-shirt.
"Here,"
he said, handing it to her. She pulled the shirt on, and he saw that he'd given her one of his favorite band shirts from a Fishbone concert he'd seen years ago with his parents and siblings.
"Your shoulder,"
Berg prompted, deciding not to obsess over the shirt, especially when she looked so cute in it. She shook her head at his prompt and again started toward the door, but a crash from the suite living room had Berg grabbing the woman's arm with one hand and shoving Coop across the bedroom and into the bathroom with the other. Berg faced the intruder, pulling the woman in behind his body. Two gunshots hit Berg in the lower chest. The man had pulled the trigger without actually seeing all of Berg, but expecting a more normal-sized human. Which meant a few things to Berg. That he was dealing with a full human. An expertly trained full human. An ex-soldier, probably. An ex-soldier with a kill order. Because if he'd been trying to kidnap the woman, he would have made damn sure he knew who or what was on the other end before he pulled that trigger. But he didn't know. He didn't check because he didn't care. Everyone in the room had to die. And knowing that, understanding that, did nothing but piss Berg off. Who just ran around trying to kill a naked, unarmed woman, his analytical side wanted to know. The grisly part of him, though, didn't care about any of that. All it knew was that it had been shot. And shooting a grizzly but not killing it immediately, always an exceptionally bad move. The snarl snaked out of Berg's throat and the muscles between his shoulders grew into a healthy grizzly hump. He barely managed to keep from shifting completely, but his grizzly bear rage exploded and his roar rattled the windows. The bathroom door behind him slammed shut. The jackal having the sense to now go into hiding. The intruder quickly backed up, knowing something wasn't right, but not fully understanding, which was why he didn't run. He should have run. With a step, Berg was right in front of him, grabbing the gun from his hand and spinning the man around so that he had him by the throat. He did this because two more men in tactical gear were coming into the suite through the front door they'd taken down moments before. Using the man's weapon, Berg shot each man twice in the chest. They both had on body armor, so he wasn't worried he'd killed them. With both attackers down, Berg refocused on the man he held captive. He spun him around because he wanted to ask him a few questions about what the hell was going on. He was calmer now. He could be rational. But when the man again faced him, Berg felt a little twinge in his side. He slowly looked down and found a combat blade sticking out. First he'd been shot, now stabbed. His grisly rage soared once again, and as the intruder, quickly recognizing his error, attempted to fight his way out of Berg's grasp, desperately begging for his life, Berg grabbed each side of his attacker's face and squeezed with both hands, until the man's head popped like a zit. It was the blood and bone hitting him in the face that snapped Berg back into the moment, and he gazed down at his brain-covered hands.
"Oh, shit,"
he muttered.
"Shit, shit, shit."
The other intruders, ignoring the pain from the shots, scrambled up and out of the suite, as far away from Berg as they could get. Someone touched his arm, and he half-turned to see the woman. She raised her hands and rewarded him with a soft smile. That's when he calmed down.
"Shit,"
he said again, holding out his hands to her. She stepped close, held his wrists, studied the blade still sticking out of his side. She then examined the wounds in his chest. Unlike the intruders, he hadn't been wearing body armor. The bullets had hit him, had entered his body. But he was grisly. Even as a human, you had to bring bigger weapons if you wanted to take down one of his kind with one or two shots. Berg knew, just watching her, that she was going to help him. She was going to try, but she was in more danger than he was, and she needed to get out of here.
"Go,"
he told her, and she frowned.
"Seriously, go."
He pulled away from her, went to his travel bag, paused to wipe the blood off his hands on a nearby towel, and took out a .45 Ruger, handing it to her.
"Take this."
Her eyes narrowed again as she stared up at him.
"I get the feeling you need it more than me,"
he pushed.
"Just go."
She took the weapon, dropped the magazine, cleared the gun with one hand before shoving the loaded mag back in and putting around in the chamber. Yeah, the woman knew how to handle his .45, maybe better than he did. She pressed her free hand against his forearm and, with a nod, slipped out the door and out of the suite.
"Can I come out now?"
Coop asked from the bathroom. But before Berg could tell him no, the jackal was already standing behind him.
"Well," Coop said, "that was interesting." "You could say that. You're bleeding." "Yes, and please stop playing with the knife."
Coop pulled his hand away from the blade handle and attempted to look contrite.
"Sorry. Does it hurt?"
Berg frowned at him, and Coop nodded.
"I'll take that glare as a yes. Maybe I should call the front desk."
He started toward the phone on the side table by the bed.
"Think we'll make our train?"
the jackal asked. Slowly, Berg faced Coop and noted,
"You're not used to real life, are you?"
"Not really.
Why?" "This is going to be big."
When Coop's head tipped to the side like a confused schnauzer, he added,
"The hotel room of some big-time penis was just violently invaded."
"It's pianist."
"Yeah, I said that."
No, he hadn't.
"Anyway, we'll have to get our story straight. And we should leave out the girl."
"Oh."
Coop thought a moment, the receiver held loosely in his hand. Finally, he said,
"I'll call my sister first."
"Why?"
"If anyone can manage this, it's Tony."
Coop winced.
"But she's going to be annoyed at you for, you know, letting this happen." "You're alive, aren't you?"
"Yes, and I'm quite grateful. And I don't hold you responsible for this at all. But my sister, she won't be as open-minded. You should prepare for that."
"I'm sure I can handle a she-jackal."
Using his cell phone to call his sister, Coop chuckled.
"Yeah, sure you can."
Staring at the open bedroom door, Berg asked,
"Think I'll ever see her again?"
"The girl that was never here?" Coop asked.
He shrugged while waiting for someone to answer on the other end of the phone.
"If you keep an eye on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, sure. Because let's face it, that's a woman who seems to have trouble following her around like a needy puppy."
Charlie avoided the elevator and found the stairs. She ran down until she reached the parking lot. She eased the door open, keeping the friendly giant's gun in her hand. She peeked around the door, didn't see anyone, so she ran toward the exit. She dodged around the expensive cars, staying low and moving fast. She dashed past a car valet and out of the lot. Charlie moved down the street, cutting around the surprising number of people who were up this early. She just reached the corner when a man in a black tactical outfit and body armor stepped in front of her. They both raised their weapons at the same time, Charlie already pulling the trigger, when a Lamborghini jumped the curb and rammed into the man. Both weapons missed their marks, but now her attacker was pinned to the ground, screaming in agony as the passenger window lowered and Charlie heard the familiar, and shockingly casual, considering the circumstances, "Hey, shithead!" The petite Asian woman with the short pixie haircut dyed blue grinned at her. They were sisters, but one would never know it by looking at them. Max McKilligan asked,
"Miss me?
Can you just drive?" Charlie got into the passenger seat. "But be careful. You still have humans stuck to the grill."
"I should let him shoot you? What kind of sister would I be?"
"One I don't have to visit in an Italian prison." Chuckling, Max put the car in reverse, and Charlie worked hard to ignore the short-lived begging and too long crunching sounds coming from under the car as she pulled out. Charlie knew her sister was taking her time driving back over the gunman. Max Kill-It-Again McKilligan was known for being vengeful. Once they were on the road and cutting through early morning Milan traffic, Max pointed down.
"Check by your feet."
Charlie did and found a small case. She opened it and let out a relieved sigh.
"Thank you," she said, putting the eyeglasses on.
Suddenly, she could see again. She hadn't had time to grab her regular pair off the bedside table before she had to make a run for it, and she hadn't gotten her contact prescription refilled in a few months. She kept forgetting. So for the last 15 minutes, everything had been one blurry mess. Even the helpful giant was just a big, blurry spot. She'd have had to get close to his face to identify him. But he had sounded cute. And so nice.
"Better?" Maxie asked.
"Much. I can now see who's trying to kill me." She looked at Max and immediately cringed at the sight.
"Oh, wow. They really beat the shit out of you."
"Excuse me?" Max replied, indignant. "These lacerations and bruises are not because of the men who came to kill me. With my usual aplomb, I have dealt with those scumbags."
"Uh-huh. Then what did happen?"
"Why do we have to discuss that? Our lives are in danger." Charlie gazed at her sister for a few moments before guessing, "Squirrels again?"
"They started it."
"It's nice to see that nothing has really changed since we last saw each other." Charlie glanced out the window, but she had to look away. Her sister was moving so fast that it was kind of making her nauseous.
"What about Stevie?"
"I'm waiting to hear back from her boss."
"Her boss?"
"She's not answering her cell, and her assistants have no idea where she is."
"Is she still in Switzerland?"
Max shrugged.
"Maybe."
"And stop glaring at me."
"How hard is it to keep an eye on one woman?"
"I take 6 months, and you take 6 months. That was our agreement."
"Why is she still our responsibility?"
"Because she's our sister, and we love her, and if we don't watch out for her, she will get involved with the wrong people and destroy the world."
"Is that what you want?"
"You always ask me that question, and you're always disappointed with my answer."
Charlie sighed.
"Well, we need to find her."
"I know.
She's in as much danger as we are."
"I know.
They sent trained military after us."
"I know.
And I know this car is stolen."
"Of course it's stolen."
"Well, that seems like kind of a problem since we have cops behind us."
"Buckle up."
"Oh, God." Charlie put on the seatbelt. "We're going to die before we even get to her."
"Stop whining. You know how hard we are to kill."
"Hard to kill doesn't mean we can't lose body parts in tragic car accidents. And we can't exactly save our little sister if we're both in prison.
And legless."
"What is your obsession with losing your legs?"
"It could happen."
Max downshifted and swerved around a truck, making a turn, barely missing the front end.
"I don't understand why you insist on worrying about something that may or may not happen,"
Maxie noted casually as a group of nuns dove out of her way, their panicked screams horrifying Charlie.
"If you lose your legs, I'll get you a wheelchair with a Ferrari motor that goes from 0 to 60 in 4 seconds.
"Wouldn't that be great?" Hands pressed against the dashboard, Charlie admitted, "I'd rather have my legs still attached to my body."
"That's such a narrow view. What about bionic legs?"
"School children," Charlie warned.
"Bionic legs would be so cool." "School children!"
"I see them."
"Calm yourself."
The car stopped, somehow, and Max patiently waited for the children and their teachers to get across the street. Out of nowhere, she began to whistle H.R. Puffin stuff. Charlie had no idea why, but she blamed her mother. She loved that crap and made them all watch it in reruns when they were too young to put up a fight. Once the children were safely out of the way, Maxie hit the gas and roared down the street, still whistling. "We need a new car," Charlie told her sister when the cops caught up with them again.
"What's wrong with this one?"
"A lot." Maxie's phone rang, and she insisted on taking one hand off the wheel to answer it.
"Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, sir."
She disconnected the call and glanced at Charlie.
"What?"
Charlie pushed when her sister didn't say anything.
"She needed a break."
"A break?
She needed a break? What does that mean?"
"You know what that means, Charlie."
"I do?"
Charlie thought a moment, then rolled her eyes.
"Oh, come on. Again?"
"You know how she is.
But hey, at least she's still in Switzerland. We'll get there in no time."
"But it's a mental hospital, not a resort." to her, all mental hospitals are resorts. Besides, it could be worse, Max said happily. This could all be so much worse. Charlie shook her head. Dude, I seriously don't know how. Chapter 2 The black Mercedes-Benz AMG G63 SUV stopped in front of the mental health and rehab clinic. Usually, it was only the wealthiest of European royalty who came to this place. Most Americans didn't even know it existed. But Charlie's baby sister had a gift. She could track down high-end mental institutions anywhere in the world. They all seemed to have spa-like amenities, five-star chefs making the meals, and group therapy, something her sister truly seemed to enjoy. The first one Stevie Stashuk McKilligan had ever checked herself into was somewhere in Malibu and cost $1,000 a day. She never paid a cent, though. The lab she interned for took care of that, which could explain why no one bothered to question why a 14-year-old girl, at the time, was checking herself into a Malibu mental health clinic without a parent or guardian in sight. And what did these brilliant and pricey psychologists discover about Stevie over the years? Exactly what Charlie already knew, that her sister was a high-strung prodigy who suffered bouts of extreme panic like any abandoned child would. Stevie's mother, a Siberian she-tiger from a very wealthy family, had shown up at Carly Taylor's door one day, asking for Carly to babysit 5-year-old Stevie for a few hours. Charlie's mom, a she-wolf who never really learned how to say no to anyone but Charlie's grandfather, agreed. After 3 days, she told Charlie and Max that, "It looks like your little sister is staying. Isn't that great?" At the time, Charlie didn't think so. It was bad enough they already had one of their father's casts off to take care of in the first place. Now they had two. But that first situation had made more sense, because Max's mother was doing hard time in a Bulgarian prison for armed robbery. She couldn't take care of her kid. But the she-tiger? She just walked away. From her own daughter. Of course, Stevie didn't let any of that bother her. In her mind, she had so many other things to worry about in the universe that her mother's desertion didn't rate as important enough for her to hold a grudge. So Charlie did it for her. She was very good at grudge-holding. Just ask her idiot father. Charlie met up with her sister at the front of the SUV. "All right," Charlie began. "You know the drill." Max nodded and flatly replied, "Go in, kill everybody, get Stevie out." Charlie briefly closed her eyes, took a moment to breathe and try to relax her shoulders. When she felt she wouldn't yell, she said, "That is not the drill." "It could be." "Could be, but isn't. The drill is, we go in, I do all the talking, you don't pick on Stevie. She's too sensitive." "But because you already know that, you're not going to pick on her." Max smiled. "What if I really want to?" "Then I'll let her take your eye out this time, and you'll wear an eye patch, and we'll call you One Eye McGee." Laughing, Max headed toward the front doors, Charlie right behind her. When they stepped inside, both of them glanced at each other. Their sister really did have a knack when it came to finding beautiful places for the mentally ill. There was so much white marble and beautiful white furniture. Stunning and expensive oriental rugs were laid out in front of white couches. White marble coffee and end tables rested on top of them. Floor-to-ceiling windows displayed the remarkable beauty of the Swiss countryside that surrounded the entire building. "You have got to be kidding," Max muttered, staring up at the cathedral-like ceilings. "I think I'm feeling mentally ill, because I could really use some Valium and a massage." "Stop it." Charlie grabbed Max's arm and pulled her to the desk, which was not white, but clear glass, and perfectly clean. The stunning woman sitting on the other side in a white button-down shirt and tight white skirt smiled, revealing perfect white teeth.
"Hello, expression the English?" Charlie asked.
"Yes," she immediately replied.
"May I help you?"
"I'd like to see my sister, Stevie McKilligan."
"Please have a seat. I'll contact her doctor."
"Thank you." Charlie walked over to the couch, but it was so white that she was worried about putting her less-than-clean body on it. Max had had an extra pair of jeans and bright red Keds in Charlie's size. They always had backup clothes for each other, so she wasn't walking around in only a T-shirt. But Charlie hadn't had time for a shower, just a quick stop at a gas station to wash the blood off and let Max bandage up her shoulder so the bullet wounds could heal without a mess. And as for Charlie, nothing would be more humiliating than getting up from that bright white couch and leaving an unfortunate stain behind. But Max didn't seem to have those issues, turning and dropping on the couch like she owned it. Of course, Max didn't worry about much, which worried Charlie. She knew her sister could be reckless when it wasn't necessary. Max did, however, always manage to find a way to wiggle out of whatever situation she'd gotten herself into. And if she couldn't wiggle free, she would attack head-on without stopping. It was the honey badger way. Max pulled a baggie of honey-covered peanuts from the back pocket of her jeans and began munching, wiping her hands on the white couch after each handful she put in her mouth.
"Dude."
Max looked up.
"What?"
"You're being sloppy."
"So?"
She gave that lovely but still off-putting smile. "We don't have to clean it up."
"Dude."
Rolling her eyes, Max pushed the nearly empty baggie back into her jeans and brushed both hands against each other. She motioned to a spot behind Charlie, and Charlie turned to see a man walking toward them. He wore a white coat and held a clipboard. He also had on a gold Rolex and Gucci leather shoes. The doctor had expensive taste. Smiling, Charlie immediately put out her hand for a shake.
"Ladies," the doctor greeted, grasping Charlie's hand.
He went for Max's, but Max just stared until he pulled his hand back. She didn't even bother getting up from the couch.
"Do you speak English?" Charlie asked.
"Of course," the doctor replied. "I am Dr. Gertner. I am the director here. Come, let's talk in my office."
He led them down the wide hallway, which looked out over the front of the building through more of those big, grand windows.
"Your center is beautiful," Charlie noted as they walked.
"Ah, danke. Thank you, I mean. We are very proud."
He ushered them into a big office with white leather chairs and couches, and even more glass windows revealing more amazing views. No wonder her sister had come here for a break. It was way better than any spa Charlie had ever been to before.
"Please, sit,"
he offered with a smile. Charlie immediately noted that except for a lamp, blotter, and phone, the man had nothing else on his desk. Maxie plopped into a chair, her legs swinging up, about to land on the man's glass desk before Charlie punched them back down. With a warning glare at her grinning sibling, she sat down on the very edge of her chair and realized she should have left Max out in the car.
"Now, how can I help you, ladies?"
"We'd like to see our sister, please."
"Ah, our dear Fräulein McKilligan."
"Dr. McKilligan," Charlie corrected out of habit.
And when Max raised an eyebrow at her, she reminded her sister she worked hard for those PhDs.
"True, true," Gertner said, still smiling. "She is one of our favorite patients here. She is so helpful during our group sessions."
Max snorted, but Charlie quickly leaned forward to keep the doctor's attention.
"I'm so glad she's here and getting the help she needs, Dr. Gertner, but we'd really love to see her for a few minutes."
"I'm sure we can arrange something in a few weeks. Right now it is too, early in the process for family meetings. You understand?"
Before Charlie could explain that, "No, I do not understand," in the politest way possible, Max slammed her fist on the expensive-looking glass desk and announced,
"Motherfucker, we want to see our sister now!"
"Max!"
Charlie barked, locking gazes with her sibling.
"Could you let me handle this, hon?"
"Thanks."
Charlie turned back to the doctor, gave a helpless shrug.
"So sorry. We've been under a lot of stress and..."
"I'm sure. But you understand that that's part of the problem, is it not?"
Charlie shook her head.
"What do you mean?"
"Fräulein McKilligan, doctor, can't afford this kind of outside stress you and your sister bring. We are leaning toward a breakthrough. But you two..."
Blinking, Charlie asked, "You're saying that we..." and she motioned between her and Max with her forefinger, are the cause of Stevie's problems? Is that what you're telling us?
Your sister loves you, Dr. Gertner insisted. But you both are, and I'm sorry for being so blunt, terrible for her.
Max sucked her tongue against her teeth and looked at Charlie. Now can I hit him? No. Not that Charlie wasn't tempted to unleash Max on the good doctor, but as much as this place might look like a spa, it wasn't. It was a mental hospital, with large orderlies. Charlie tried again. I understand your concerns, Doctor. I really do. But if I could just get 3 minutes alone with my sister, I would absolutely...
Nine,
the doctor said flatly, although with a smug smile on his face that Charlie desperately wanted to slap off. The doctor stood.
But I will tell her that you are here when I think the time is right, and we will plan on a controlled meeting between you three. Very soon.
Charlie started to go across the desk just so she could tear the good doctor's nose off, but she didn't have a chance. She was too busy grabbing hold of Max and yanking her back before the badger could clear the glass and wrap herself around Gertner's body like a python. Charlie stood, bringing Max along, her grip tight on the tough flesh of her sister's back. Well, Charlie said, dragging her snarling sister along, we look forward to hearing from you, Doctor. I'm sure you have my number on file.
Of course.
Charlie walked toward the glass door and opened it. She pushed her sister out and hissed in warning when Max turned to go back into the doctor's office. As they headed toward the front of the building, Charlie glanced back and saw that several orderlies were following behind them, making sure they left the building without a fuss. Once outside, the orderlies stood in front of the doors, preventing the sisters from re-entering. Charlie and Max stopped by the SUV's passenger side and faced each other.
Now can I go in and kill everybody? Max asked.
No.
You and your half-canine morals. It does nothing but get in the way.
I know you're working hard to be a sociopath, but stop it.
Sociopath is in the eye of the forensic psychologist working for the prosecution?
Berg was eventually sent to the local hospital to get his wounds checked out, but the local cops made it clear that they didn't like what Berg and Coop were trying to sell. The investigators knew the pair were hiding something. They just weren't sure what, exactly. It helped, though, that Coop wasn't just Coop, but Cooper Jean-Louis Parker, master musician and former child prodigy. The Italian authorities could only push so hard, especially since they were already dealing with the repercussions of being the city where Jean-Louis Parker had been attacked. Every news service, even in the United States, was reporting on the attack and what happened to the much-beloved American maestro. The first doctor that came into the exam room had been full human, and after looking over Berg's wounds, had abruptly left. A few minutes later, a female doctor came in. She was older, with unbelievably long legs and a strong, lean body. A cheetah. Her nose twitched once, and she smirked at Berg.
You worried my associate, she said in charmingly accented English. He thought you must be on steroids to be so big.
Then he saw that you were already healing.
She washed her hands, dried them, and put on gloves.
He wanted to run many tests, check you in for the night. I told him that would not be necessary.
She grinned, fangs briefly extending.
I am his boss, so he has to listen to me. He hates that, but for some reason, she added with a shrug, I seem to scare him.
She leaned over and examined the wound in his side, her fingers pushing against the flesh. It hurt like a bitch, but he wasn't about to admit that to a cat.
This is already healing. No point in doing more.
She straightened and looked closely at the gunshot wounds on his chest.
These are already healing, too, but I will need to open them up to get the bullets out. We don't want the skin healing over those. That could lead to infection and fever.
She pressed her wrist against his forehead.
Good. You do not have a fever so far. I will make this quick. You don't need to go under, do you? Before I do this?
A local would be... Ow!
Do not be big baby cub,
she ordered while she began digging in his flesh with sterilized metal instruments.
Berg was gritting his teeth as she worked, waiting for this to be over, when the exam room door flew open.
"What are you doing to my brother?"
a female version of himself demanded.
"I could hear him whimpering outside."
"Helping his big, dumb bear ass,"
the doctor replied before she glanced back and up. Her hands froze, and a small growl came from the back of her throat.
"This is my sister, Britta,"
Berg explained, knowing his sister's size alone was making the cheetah nervous. Female grizzlies were the most feared among the shifters. Not only were they psychotically protective of those they considered family, blood or otherwise, they were, like the males, easily startled. One wrong move could lose a shifter an arm or a whole head.
"And my sister is going to be calm now. Calm because I'm fine."
The doctor seemed to accept that until a male mirror image of Berg also walked into the room and, after slamming the door, glared around without saying a word.
Berg sighed. "And that's my brother, Dag. We're triplets."
"Your poor mother,"
the doctor motioned to the far side of the room.
"You two, over there."
Britta angrily snapped, "You don't order me around."
"Britta, please,"
Berg nearly begged.
"Instruments digging into my chest. Think about that a moment before you say anything else."
With a nod, Britta immediately moved to the corner of the room, but Dag, oblivious as always, leaned in and watched the doctor trying to dig out that bullet. Berg knew his brother was just curious. He'd always been fascinated by medical procedures. But that didn't mean the cheetah would understand. In fact, she was starting to sweat a little, and the room was cool. But before Berg could warn his brother off with a growl, Britta came back and grabbed Dag's arm, yanking him over to the corner. Could a cheetah take out three bears? With thumbs, access to lethal surgical supplies, medical training, and blinding speed, there was a definite chance. And why risk it when she was, in her own cat-like way, trying to help? "You know what's happening right now, don't you?" Britta asked from the corner.
"Coop's sister is getting a private jet to come over here."
Coop said that might happen.
"Don't worry, I'll handle her," Britta promised. She suddenly pointed at Berg.
"When the cat is done, I have name, Big Bottom Bear.
You and Dag will need to get Coop to Rome, then back to the States."
"Coop's still doing that concert?"
"There are some people you don't cancel on. The Pope is definitely one of them. But the remainder of the shows are going to have to be canceled."
Berg cringed, and not just from pain. "That's not good."
"It's not that bad. There are only two more after Vatican City," Britta reminded him.
"Yeah," Berg sighed, "but those two shows are in Russia. Those Kamchatka bears are gonna bitch if we cancel. They do love their Jean-Louis Parker."
"Don't sweat it," Britta said, her head down as she was busy texting on her phone. "Coop says he'll add St. Petersburg and some city in Siberia, and that should quiet the bears and the tigers and the Cossacks."
Berg blinked. "There are still Cossacks?"
"Of course there are still Cossacks," Britta snapped.
"How am I supposed to know? I'm not Russian."
"Are you almost done?" Britta asked the doctor, her tone typically commanding, despite her lack of power with an Italian medical doctor who was also a cat.
"I'm done when I am done, Sal. Do not pressure me."
"So who was the girl?" Britta abruptly asked, attempting to throw her brother off.
"What girl?"
Berg asked, working to keep his face blank, a skill he picked up from their father.
"The girl."
The doctor paused in the middle of her work.
"You went tense, Bear."
Ignoring the doctor, Berg told his sister,
"There was no girl, just me and Coop in the room."
"Uh-huh," his sister replied before refocusing on her phone.
"Dessau knows you lie,"
the cheetah teased softly, but Berg already knew that. Stevie McKilligan leaned forward, her elbows on her knees, her chin resting on her raised, clasped hands.
"And how does that make you feel?" she asked the patient across from her, "that your mother treats you like that?"
"Awful. I deserve better."
"You do deserve better," Stevie insisted.
Just because your mother is the dictator of a small country and kills those she considers enemies of the state doesn't mean that your opinion doesn't matter.
You're right, Stevie. You're so right.
Stevie turned to the man next to her. And what about you, Jacques? How are you feeling? Are you still upset about losing that yacht race?